This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, The Beast Within, exploring characters with a darker side.
Yes, that's right, folks. Today, we're not going to be looking at female characters.
Yes.
Well...
Well, there might be one or two, but mostly this is a trope that gets applied to male characters for reasons we will go into at length.
Yes.
Our other reason is that our last two episodes were quite lengthy explorations of things about female characters.
So yes.
Let's go in the other direction.
Yeah, let's balance this out a little bit. Let's talk about some other things, because, now... I think that's part of the reason why this episode... Good. My language skills are improving every day. It's part of the reason why we're doing this episode. I think the other reason is that Jules is finally, after years of me badgering her, watching Lucifer.
It's true. I'm, like, almost all the way through season two. And I'm really, really enjoying it. And I would have liked to have watched it before, but... If you want me to read something, chances are I'll get to it really quickly. If you want me to watch something, it takes longer because I literally really only watch television in the evenings with Alan, so it kind of needs to be something that he likes as well or might like. And then it's a limited amount of time, so that's why it's taken me so long. But it looks like we might mainline the whole lot now, so that'll be good.
Yes.
But yes, midway through season two, I was kind of like, oh, this would make quite an interesting Dissecting Dragons episode.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, we might be a bit spoilery about Lucifer, simply because he's one of the characters we do actually want to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. But don't worry, we'll only really be spoilery up to season two.
Yes. So. Because otherwise we'd be spoilering me, and I'm not okay with that.
So as we said, we are mostly going to be looking at male characters today, and that is because, number one, it's a trope that applies far more to male characters than female characters, though obviously not exclusively. And as we said, we have been focusing very much on the sort of female perspective and female characters in the past. So let's get stuck into it, and I think the first thing we need to do is actually define what we mean by the beast within.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the same as sort of our episode on, like, the demon lover, for example. Mm. This is a very specifically, the setup is usually a genuinely nice, mild-mannered guy who has a darker side that is beyond his control and can make him act out in ways that he does not anticipate.
Yeah.
It's, I wouldn't say it's quite like having an illness, but it's almost you have to plan ahead in the same sort of way, as in you don't know when you're going to have a really bad flare-up.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So usually it's that he's not even aware. He might not even be aware that he has, like, this beast within. So you get that with the typical classic werewolf, you know, where becoming a wolf is a curse. He's there. I mean, sometimes there's even the narrative, which is the person hunting the wolf is actually also the wolf, and they haven't even realised.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, what they end up with usually is a block of missed time. The transformation itself is usually really, really painful, and they tend to wake up not knowing what they've done.
Yeah.
Honestly, that's a little bit like being a student, isn't it? But yeah.
Jules's university experience and my university experience were very different. It makes me think probably a good example from relatively recent TV series is Being Human.
That's the one I was thinking of. I love the character George, the werewolf.
Yeah.
Because he's literally the sweetest. He's really sweet. He's intelligent. He's compassionate. He's caring. He works as an orderly and all the patients love him.
Yeah.
And then there's a full moon and he's kind of like complete rampage.
Yeah, exactly. I always think of this one particular scene where he and Mitchell are like they both had really bad days, and Mitchell's the vampire that he lives with, and they're like, oh, he's like, oh hey, do you want to watch the I can't even remember what TV show it was. It was like something really random, which wasn't even that exciting. They're like, hey, you wanna watch that? And George is like, yeah, you know what, I would really like that. And they turn on the TV, is like, they've switched the schedules, it's already gone, it's already passed. And he's like, what? No, I was really looking forward to that. I hate it when they switch the schedules like this. I've been relying on this all week. And they just both have this massive breakdown. George lying on the sofa sobbing, and Mitchell's like, I'm doing the cleaning up now. There, are you happy?
And you, I know, it's brilliant.
You know, Annie the ghost, like, what the hell have I just witnessed? And it's just George curled up on the side, like, just crying. Because they couldn't watch this TV show. I always remember that scene. And yeah, it's he's this very sweet, mild-mannered, caring person. And I remember there's one episode where, in order to try and contain the wolf, he actually drugs himself before he sort of transforms. And then he films himself. And basically, it's just like a 12-hour film of a sleeping wolf. And he's like, great, fantastic. So now I know I can really sort of control the wolf. I don't even have to worry about him escaping or anything like that, because I can just drug him. But then what happens is, because he hasn't released this aggression during his time as the wolf, he starts to get incredibly aggressive in his day-to-day instead, in a very uncharacteristic way, which I thought was very, very interesting. This idea that actually, because he was a werewolf now, there was a certain amount of energy which he actually needed to expel, which was potentially why he became the wolf. And by trying to repress that, it actually fed into his day-to-day.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that Buffy the Vampire Slayer does as well with Oz, who becomes... He gets bitten by his 3-year-old nephew, who apparently is a werewolf. Literally just sort of bitten on the finger, and he's not aware of it. And he's a small guy, and he's confident and really laid back and stoic and a bit taciturn, and you know, he's totally chill. And then the full moon rises and it just really screws up his life. And as you go through the seasons, it really, really does screw up his life in many ways. But it's, I think, it works so well with the classic werewolf trope, because it's such a juxtaposition between a genuinely nice person and this uncontrollable beast. And in the sense of, it's a wolf, not in in nature terms, not in a David Attenborough sense, but in a sort of like, no, this is a like a sort of exterior personalization of everything, every nasty thing within the human soul kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, that really works. And if you watch things like any of the old Wolfman films or anything like that, they're, or you know, American Werewolf in London, which is a very funny film as well and quite horrific.
Yeah.
But it's also, they're all tragedies. They're all sad. The only way you can actually contain a werewolf in the end is that the person who loves the werewolf can get close enough to kill it. And it's just really, really sad.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next one of The Beast Within is when you have a character who is aware of this sort of darker side, but they're desperately trying to fight against it. So obviously the Hulk is a really good example of this, specifically early Hulk.
Yes, specifically. And I think it plays into, again, that trope of, you know, sort of educated, decent bloke suddenly completely out of his own control.
Yeah, and there's also usually this, I think they like to have this incredible sort of difference between educated, decent bloke who's not particularly muscular, who's maybe a tiny bit weedy, you know, who's definitely not out there lifting weights or anything like that, suddenly becomes this literal force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, definitely. I always really liked the character of Bruce Banner, and I was always a bit meh about the Hulk. I mean, you won't remember, probably, the actual 80s TV show of the Hulk, where it was literally just an ordinary, slightly muscular guy in green paint. This was the sort of thing that I had as entertainment as a child.
Explains so much.
It really does, doesn't it? But that was weirdly, I mean, aside from the terrible makeup and everything, that was a weirdly kind of nuanced look at human nature. And, you know, that was riffing directly off the comics. And, you know, we'll talk a bit more about the Hulk in a minute, because there's a very specific trope that's worth examining.
Yeah.
But yeah, being aware of it, and it's like the early Hulk, let's say early Hulk, mid-Hulk film, where it's Edward Norton playing Bruce Banner, and he's disappeared off into the middle of nowhere in an attempt to sort of like, I need to be away from people and away from people who are going to like spike my anger levels, because because that's when the Hulk comes out. And I suppose, in a weird way, it kind of reminds me a little bit like when Picard is taken over by the Borg. Not in the sense of it's the Beast Within thing, but in the sense of everything that made you a cultured, intelligent, educated, almost Renaissance type man, who's very well-rounded, is taken away from you, and you just become this mindless force of destruction.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny, because as time has gone on, I think people have tried to make Hulk a little bit more nuanced. You have these little jokes. I think there, it's definitely in Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes, the cartoon series, which is very good, by the way. I highly recommend it. I think they did have this joke where every now and again Hulk would say something that would prove that he was hyper intelligent, that he had all of Banner's intelligence, which was very funny, because it also created this thing that Hulk is not being stupid because he's stupid, or Hulk is not sort of being action first, thinking later, because he doesn't have the capacity to understand or think through things. It's that this sheer sort of like adrenaline is just who he is. He's prioritized action over thinking, rather than, you know, Banner, who's usually thinking over action.
Yeah, and it's, yeah, the two halves are constantly at war with each other.
Yeah.
And it's something that in the Avengers films, I think, he doesn't get a lot of screen time, because once you put something that literally gets stronger every time you hit it on stage, it's really difficult to then bring everybody else in on the same level. So they kept his part relatively small, but it's little things like, well, when I got really low, I tried to swallow a bullet and the green guy spat it out, kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's just a case of there's literally no escape. The only escape is finding some sort of balance between the two states.
Yeah.
Which they then do in a later film, where he's like, he's the Hulk all the time. He's kind of like, yeah, I'm just chill all the time, kind of thing.
He's the Hulk but Banner.
He's the Hulk but Banner. And I get why they did that, because it was really difficult to continue filming around it. But at the same time, I kind of felt that they, I don't know, pull the slightly cheesy fast one.
Yeah.
But they played it for laughs, and it was very funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
It, you know, this is something that sort of you get in certain vampire tropes as well.
Yeah. In the fighting back the beast. I mean, to be honest, there's a little bit of that in Angel, isn't there?
There's definitely some of that in Angel. Obviously, the Joss Whedon vampires are supposedly humans possessed by a demon, so again you have that two halves. Your conscience is gone, but they say your soul is gone, but I think it's more like your conscience is gone, and the demon is there with you all the time instead. And even dare I say it, Twilight, in the sense of, you know, that the way that the vampires work is blood is acts on them like blood would act on a shark.
Yeah.
So it takes a great deal of strength of will not to want to indulge in human blood.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So the next one is that the character may have a dark side which is thrust upon them through events beyond their control, and they are desperately then trying to reinvent themselves. So I think this is the point we start talking about Lucifer.
Yes, I mean, I think he gets a special section of his own a bit later as well, but yes, definitely. It's really interesting. They've obviously, creators of Lucifer obviously really sort of, I say the source material, by the source material I mean everything from Paradise Lost to Guns N' Roses' Sympathy for the Devil, for as far as I can see. Strangely enough, the devil is a really, really popular figure in fiction.
Mm.
And you'd think that that character would be very one note. But they've made him a really nuanced, interesting character. They've literally taken the idea of him being a fallen angel and run with it. And it's the idea that actually he didn't really want to rule hell. He just wanted his own free will. And he was basically thrust into the role of head torturer.
Yeah. It was a job.
Yeah.
And the other thing I really like is it plays on this idea of truth and actually the role of the devil, because think about it. People say the devil is evil, right? Then why does the devil punish evildoers? Why doesn't he, try to encourage evil? Well, some say he does try to encourage evildoers, but you know, if the devil is evil, why is he punishing evildoers? Why is he not, you know, celebrating them? Why is he not giving them special positions and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's weird in the sense of there's, you know, the vaguely sort of late medieval idea of making a deal with the devil and selling your soul, etc., etc., which then gets played on by occultists through sort of the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. You know, the Golden Dawn kind of touched on that a little bit. And, you know, if you've ever read any Dennis Wheatley, you'll know that a bulk of those stories are about someone making an ill-advised Faustian bargain of some kind. But yeah, he's supposed to tempt people, but not actually kill anyone. I mean, the thing that I'm noticing most about Lucifer is the fact that God is the bad guy. We're assuming God is real and Lucifer talks like he is and Lucifer always tells the truth. Well, God is definitely the bad guy in that show.
Yeah, I like it because they're nuanced. And they're especially nuanced because Lucifer does have free will, because he fought for free will, essentially. And he was then made into head torturer. And he gets especially annoyed in the show when everyone blames their bad actions on him. And he's turning around saying, no, I did not make you go around murdering people. I did not make you do that. I never made you do that. Lucifer's temptations basically seem to resort to people having a good time and not people running around and hurting people. And I think that it's quite amazing because the way that they've portrayed Lucifer also really plays into things like actual Satanism. And for the people who, you know, the Satanic Bible and stuff like that, which basically it says that you can do what you want, but you must respect other people. Consent is key and stuff like that.
Okay, I'm just gonna correct you, but just draw a line, because we're talking about the American version of Satanism there, whereas in the UK the long history of Satanism is not that. It's very much pervert the Catholic Church.
Yeah, no, okay, fair enough, yes. we'll put the UK thing aside because I think that's just a bit weird. So for once, we're actually going to go
Satanism
to the America.
Over here is...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost not Satanism. It's almost like a following on from the Golden Dawn, the American version. And it's this is not doing anyone down at all. But it's fluffy by comparison to the whole sort of turning the Catholic mass on its head and being literally anti-Christian, which is what the Satanism that grew up here was doing.
Yeah, though of course you do have to remember that Lucifer is an American show.
Yeah, absolutely, and they should definitely draw from their own sources. But
yeah,
when we're talking about Satanism, let's just be clear that there's two versions and we're talking about the nice version.
Yeah, but we're talking about the American version. They're drawing from that, and I think you can see they've really done their research there. And obviously Neil Gaiman is also, you know, a big part of it, because he created the character. I say he created the character of Lucifer. This version of Lucifer he created.
I actually wouldn't be surprised, you know, if he'd sort of like popped into a time machine and whispered in Milton's ear. It's Neil Gaiman. It's possible, isn't
it's
it?
Entirely possible, yeah. But yeah, so it seems to be that Lucifer really embodies, you know, the American version of Satanism in the way that he acts, in the way that he sort of, he pushes against the establishment, and in the fact that he always tells the truth. And yeah, he's up to no good a lot of the time. He's taking drugs, he's, you know, drinking, he's behaving recklessly and stuff like that. But you know what he's not doing? He's never hurting people who he feels don't deserve to be hurt.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there are times when his desire to punish people definitely does start to get beyond his control.
Yes.
Or, you know, he's tempted to follow it beyond his own control, if that's a better way of putting it.
Yeah. It's funny.
Bear in mind, he's a fallen archangel, so he can literally throw people across rooms without breaking a sweat.
Yeah, he's incredibly strong. And I think the thing with Lucifer is that Lucifer is like an overgrown child in the way that his development has gone, which kind of, I think that they do that quite well, and that he has these sort of temper tantrums, which I think they play into that very much, in that it's almost like trauma. And he is, he's dealing with trauma quite a lot. The trauma of what happened to him, the trauma of everyone on Earth basically blaming him for their own ill doings, the trauma of what his father did to him, you know, the way that he perceives everything. And that causes him to lash out. And the way he lashes out isn't excusable. He does still have to account for his actions. And I think that's really important. But for me, it's really interesting to see how trauma can make people lose control of themselves, and how that doesn't necessarily make what they do all right, and it's not forgivable, but it's understandable.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree with that. And aside from anything else, it is a really, really fun exploration of someone trying to reinvent themselves.
Yeah.
So, I mean, as you mentioned Angel earlier, a certain amount of that is, I'm going to move to the big city, to LA, strangely enough, again, and reinvent myself. Apparently that's what you do. You go to LA and reinvent yourself. But Angel is also tied up with atonement, whereas Lucifer's just kind of like, I'm bored of hell. I don't want to stay here anymore.
Yeah. I'm also not going to lie, I really like Amenadiel.
I'm low-key in love with Mazakim.
Yeah.
And she is very much more sort of... you can't say she's bad, because she doesn't have any real polarities. It's just a case of she's naturally more drawn to darkness. She's a demon, so
yeah,
she's kind of like, oh, what, we can totally tear them up and torture them, and not in a fun way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And she's fine with it, and I'm like, I can respect that.
Yeah.
I like Amenadiel, but he's kind of like a bit of a dick, and the fact that he's now, you know, some bad things have kind of happened to him, I'm kind of like, I was actually sitting there getting annoyed because he'd been a dick, and I wanted to carry on disliking him, not start feeling sorry for him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I agree. I like Amenadiel's sort of redemption arc, as it were. But I like it as well because he's meant to be the good angel, and Lucifer's meant to be the bad angel, and yet Amenadiel is doing some seriously shady shit in season one.
Yeah, big time.
A big sort of the means justify the ends kind of argument there, which obviously they don't.
Well, that supreme confidence that he's doing the Lord's work kind of thing.
And yeah.
The more he stays in the human world, the more he questions things and the less clarity he has.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, he does some really shady shit.
Very shady.
Okay,
anyway,
our final example is someone who starts off as a nice guy in real life but feels perhaps a bit slighted, a bit sort of overlooked, might even have a touch of nice guys finish last going on,
yeah,
and actively attempts to embrace the dark side of his personality, only to realise he has no control over it. It takes over.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, we're looking at things like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, or the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, if we're talking about the book.
Mm-hmm.
But Jekyll and Hyde, in the sense of, I think almost every show at some point, if it's a sort of supernaturally type show, has had an episode like this, if
yeah.
it's run long enough.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the other thing is that people tend to sort of forget that Dr. Jekyll does it on purpose.
Yeah, very much in the sense of, yeah, there's some scientific curiosity going on, but there's also a sense of wanting to attain significance.
Yeah.
And just literally, you know how, I don't, various different training things will, for marketing and for if you work with the public, will say everyone's going around with this little sign on their head saying, make me feel important, because that's our default status.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you work in the public sector, then the best thing you can do is learn to identify that and make people feel like you're really listening to them.
Yeah.
He's kind of got this make me feel important thing going on, but actually kind of feels slightly invisible. So this whole attempt to embrace the purient curiosity of what is the darker, more violent side of man? What are we like when you strip away the conscience and the illusion of civility?
Hmm.
And it's, you know, it doesn't make for a likeable character. You're not supposed to be feeling sort of, oh, sorry, poor Dr. Jekyll kind of thing.
No, it's a decision he does make, and that he indulges in, because he likes being that darker side of him. He likes exploring that darker side of him. Because, as you say, maybe he feels insignificant in, you know, as Dr. Jekyll. Maybe he feels repressed. It's quite interesting, and I'm not going to go too much on about it because it's sort of going on a tangent. But there are a lot of readings which also look at it and say, actually, it's not so much about the darker side of nature. It could be read as, you know, exploring your true self, particularly among, you know, if you're queer or something along those lines. And the reason everyone sees it as darker is because they don't approve of it. But that's a whole other discussion anyway. But there's still this element of the exploration of something within yourself which is untouched, or which you're not allowed to, which society says you're not allowed to explore, but which gives you a sense of power and even identity or things like that. So Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde is a very interesting narrative, because it is quite multi-layered.
Yeah, I've also seen it described as an early exploration of things like mental health.
Yes.
Where you can, you know, you can be sort of, let's say, appropriate for society or moment, and then completely beyond the ken of man the next,
yeah.
Because obviously they genuinely didn't really understand mental health issues. And, you know, it's something we're still learning now.
Yeah.
Where some of these things fall down for me is that Mr. Hyde actually sort of abuses and murders prostitutes. So it gets to a point where it's like, you are beyond the realms of sympathy at some
yes.
point.
Yes, no, I completely agree with that.
I do think it's an interesting exploration, and I've seen it sort of brought into things like, for example, if you've watched Breaking Bad,
yeah.
The entirety of Breaking Bad is Walter White, the main character, starting off as very typical, mild-mannered, etc. And you could even say, yes, he's pushed to do this because the unfairness of the tax system, etc., and what he's being paid, going into making crystal meth, which is like one of the worst drugs ever. But the whole thing is ultimately, he's not doing it for money in the end. He's not doing it for his family. This is a quest for personal significance, because he's spent his entire life feeling insignificant. And in the end, he's willing to die for that significance.
Yeah. It makes me think of, there's one joke in Breaking Bad which always gets me, which is that they use their sort of their chemistry know-how to make really nice coffee.
Yes.
And he drinks coffee, he's like, that's the best damn cup of coffee I've ever had in my life. Why are we making meth? And you know what, Walter White, you could have done that. He could have been like, I'm opening a coffee shop. He didn't, because that's not actually what it was about. It wasn't about making money. It was actually about something else entirely.
Yeah, it was about grabbing power within your own life. And I don't know, the whole sort of him having stage 3 cancer at the beginning of the show was kind of like a big wake-up call for what have you been doing? You've been sleepwalking through your entire life. So suddenly he's doing all this risk-taking behaviour. And we like it. We like watching him be a complete badass. And then eventually a tipping point comes and you're like, it's really hard to sympathise with this guy now.
Yeah. At first he's sympathetic, and then you realise that actually he's not a good person in the least. And hasn't actually ever really been. Yeah. He was just letting it go bit by bit, but you kind of see the core of who he is underneath it all, and it's not a good person.
Yeah. So it is a really, really interesting juxtaposition, sort of someone who seeks out that darker side.
Yeah.
They may not be someone you actually want to hang out with in real life, but they're definitely interesting to read.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so why is this trope so prevalent, predominantly with male characters?
Puberty!
Yeah, the first one is very much, it's an obvious metaphor for male puberty with the Hulk. Which is literally what the Hulk in the comics was designed to be.
Mm.
This idea that you'd start off being this skinny little shrimp one day, and then the next day your voice had dropped 2 octaves, you had massive hands and feet that you couldn't control, and you went to open a door and tore the door off its hinges kind of thing.
And you felt angry.
And, you know, Alan and I have discussed this at length, and he's like, I don't think you really get male puberty. I'm like, well, no, because I've not been through male puberty. But he's like, no, seriously, you start off being really sort of this small little thing, and then the next thing you know, you're this massive beast full of rage. You don't know what to do with any of it.
I always remember one of the stories my mother told, because my brother and I ended up going to school away from home, so we wouldn't see our parents for months at a time. Yeah. And at the beginning of the semester, my mother sends off her little angel boy, you know, with his straight little hair, and he's all short, and he's got little bit chubby cheeks, and she's like, all right, I'll see you in the summer. And off he goes. And when he returns, she doesn't recognise him, because first
hello,
of all...
Hello, Mum.
Yeah, kind of thing. But it wasn't just that. He had shot up, his hair had gone extremely curly, because that was something that happened to both of us in puberty. We had very straight hair, and then the moment puberty hit, our hair went incredibly curly. So his hair had suddenly gone incredibly curly. He'd shot up, and his voice had dropped an octave. And so, you know, he walks right up to her, and she's still looking through the crowd trying to find him. And he's like, "Hi, Mom." She's like, "Oh God, it's you."
Yeah, that would be really... I don't have any brothers. My only comparable experience is coming back from university after my first year, and my mum bursting into hysterical giggles when I stood next to my younger sister. My younger sister is 8 years younger than me, so when when I was 19, she would have been 13, and she was towering above me. And she was much broader than me as well. And Mum's like, no, you don't understand what I'm seeing. And she stood us both in front of the mirror in the living room. And I was like, oh, I get it now, kind of thing.
For any listeners who don't know about Jules, Jules is very small.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jules is tiny. I once gave Jules a mug. We have this oversized mug in the house. And because Jules is a tea fanatic, I gave her the large mug, and then sat and laughed for about 5 minutes at her, because she could barely get her hands around the whole mug. It looked like I'd just given like a mouse a teacup. It was really funny.
And yet I valiantly drank from that mug and refilled it.
You did, you did. The other experience is trying to watch Jules reach the top lock on one of the doors that she was trying to get in, and she's jumping up and down going, "Eah!
You don't know I was doing that, because you were outside. You'd locked me in your house. Madeline texts me to say, hey, come out, we're sat out in the garden. And I'm like, how do I get out of the house? And finally, I had to get a chair to stand on to unbolt one of the doors because I couldn't reach.
So, yes.
Never-ending source of amusement there, apparently.
Yes, so funny. Anyway.
But yes, it is quite a good metaphor for male puberty. Obviously, it doesn't excuse any of the things that, you know, male puberty as well, doesn't excuse any of the things that you might be inclined to do.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think leading on to the next point, it is an exploration of the fact that if you happen to have a lot of testosterone, we can't say that it doesn't have any biological effect on you. It absolutely does. In the same way that when girls go through puberty, the progesterone, the estrogen and things will change their bodies as well. You know, hormones are supposed to affect you. So, it's not to say that you'll have a natural tendency as boys to be more reckless and potentially more aggressive.
Yeah, for the average,
if we're just talking on average sort of biological level, I'm not going into anything else, but in the same way that, you know, girls will go through their last bit of growth quite quickly because we sort of become biologically ready to give birth fairly early on, whereas boys are still growing up until they're about 21. That's normal for the average male, female, etc. And, you know, there's a rage component with estrogen and progesterone as well, as any woman who, you know, regularly has periods and things will tell you. Simply because, you know, that is one of the side effects, or, you know, crying jags as well for some people. Depends. So in some ways, this sort of beast within thing is a bit of an exploration of baseline biological matters, and the fact that those baseline biological imperatives don't necessarily line up with what you should be doing, and the fact that you can still govern yourself despite everything.
Yeah, it can be quite difficult though. Like, particularly when you're a teenager and suddenly you find yourself flying into a rage over something which is, you know, very small, or sometimes not a rage, sometimes sort of breaking into floods of tears over something which would not usually sort of bring you to tears. And I think that something the reason a lot of women particularly get quite annoyed when I was like, are you being illogical? It doesn't matter whether the tears or the anger are illogical, because the strength of the emotion is there. You are getting a huge response from your body, which you don't have control over, which takes actually a lot more training and a lot more kind of experience to be able to get under control. As if it were an incredibly big thing, even if comparatively it's a very small thing. And so it does take experience. It takes a little while to level out. And of course, if you're also, you know, if this has just started happening to you, no wonder people get angry. No wonder you get boys who, you know, end up breaking things, or girls who end up screaming at the top of their voices for something that's comparatively very silly. You have this huge response that you're not prepared for. Because you haven't geared up towards it.
And coupled with the fact that your brain does not stop developing till you're 25, so you don't really have frontal lobes properly yet.
Yeah.
And that's where most of your reasoning and forward thinking and planning goes on, in your frontal lobes. So you're coupling puberty with the idea that you stop being a child, you're not really an adult. Society treats you like that, and it treats you differently depending on whether you're male or female, mm-hmm. biologically, without bringing anything else that might be going on into it, mm-hmm. as a thing at the same time. And then on top of that, you literally do not have the mental furniture to deal with it at that point in time.
Mental furniture.
Well, yeah, you don't have the equipment. It's not there.
Yeah.
So this is a cocktail. I mean, people talk about teenage tantrums and things, and some teenagers don't have them in the same way. Some of them the sly little buggers that go off and do whatever the fuck they want anyway. They just don't bother to argue about it, i.e. me. But most teenagers will have moments where it seems like they're talking about the end of the world, and what they're talking about is not being able to go out one evening.
Yeah, and but that's the thing.
Is that's normal.
It does literally feel like the end of the world. I do remember having, and this was always the difference between if I was in a really bad mood and my brother would say, "Are you on your period?" or "Are your periods about to start?" and I'd fly into a rage because I'd be like, "It doesn't matter because you have actually literally made me this angry, regardless of the fact that I might not always get this angry. You've made me this angry. These feelings are still real, even if they're not sort of proportionate to what you'd usually expect." And then flip to the other side, which is me having an argument with my mother, getting really, really angry with her, and sort of feeling totally out of control. And she heard her in a very quiet voice saying, "Madeline, are your periods about to start?" And I was like, "Probably." And then I just stood there and sulked, like, okay, I realise the reason I'm so angry right now is probably because I don't have control over it, but it doesn't change the fact I'm really angry.
Like, my brain is flooded with chemicals that are making me act irrationally, but I'm still feeling it.
But it was great, because the moment my mother knew that, she'd be like, okay, so I'm not going to press this issue. I'm just going to wait until those emotions have drained out, and then we can talk about it a little bit more. She's not actually upset with me, she's just upset.
It's kind of like, yeah, this is basically like arguing with a drunk, you know, you're not going to get a sensible answer until they've sobered up a little bit. And as funny as, you know, we can find this now, I think it's also worth looking at the fact that on top of everything we've just said, with the whole biological imperative being a teenager, etc., not being really set up to cope with everything, there's also a societal pressure as well. We're gradually moving away from this sort of boys will be boys attitude.
Yeah.
But it is still kind of there a little bit. And, you know, in converse with girls, it's kind of like, well, yeah, you know, she's a girl, she's going to be more irrational, she's going to be more emotional, she'll cry more easily, etc. You don't have to pay as much attention to her.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, it's kind of like boys acting out is boys will be boys. Girls acting out is kind of like, oh, she's a girl, don't pay any attention. This is not a great combination, really, particularly for teenagers.
Yeah, absolutely. It always boggled the mind, though, whenever they said, oh, we can't have female rulers because she'll be on her periods and then she'll nuke everybody. And I'm like, and yet at the same time, these people are also the same ones who breathe the narrative of boys will be boys and say, okay, well, when a boy gets pissed off, you know, he will punch something. And I'm like, how can you say, how can you put forward a narrative that says women can't control themselves, therefore they don't make good rulers, whilst also saying men are better rulers because they can't control themselves? How can you put that narrative forward? That makes no sense.
Yeah, definitely. And we're only talking about sort of the perceived biological average here. There are many, many girls who need an aggressive outlet, who need sports, who need to be encouraged in that way, who even need controlled amounts of violence in the terms of, you know, you may want to sign them up for a martial art or something, because they need that outlet. And there are boys who need more sensitive outlets through puberty.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're kind of missing a big picture here, I think, with some of it.
I should also say that women can have testosterone too.
Yeah, absolutely.
I love that people are like, oh, it's exclusively masculine. No, no. And I'm not even talking about trans women. I'm talking about cis women as well. Do have testosterone.
you have as a cis woman always got a small amount of testosterone. And then once you go through the menopause, your testosterone levels will rise because your other hormone levels will dip. It's the balancing act of having progesterone and estrogen which keeps the testosterone low. So when you go through menopause and those dip, your testosterone levels go up, which is why you get some side effects such as, for example, facial hair as you get older. Some women will.
Facial hair and rage.
Facial hair and rage. It's the testosterone. It'd be nice if you got super buff with it as well, but that doesn't seem to happen. It's a lot easier to put muscle on with testosterone.
Yeah. And a lot easier to put on fat with, whatchamacallit.
Yeah. Okay,
so... You gotta be squishy, you gotta be squishy!
You must be well padded for your babies. So, I'm not having any babies, I don't care, you've reached 25 and I notice you've not had a child yet, I'm going to make your hips a bit wider.
This will help. No, it won't. Stop it.
Your hips wider and slightly larger breasts. And it's like, yeah, you're not getting the hint here. I'm not going to have children. Okay, we'll expand again.
I just like the idea. It's like, she's not having babies. Quick, make her boobs bigger. Men will flock.
And the sad thing is, this does actually happen. Not the men flocking bit necessarily, but the everything expanding. Your secondary sex characteristics getting really, really out of proportion.
Okay, moving away from the topic at hand.
We did say we were going to talk about blokes, didn't we? So,
yeah.
Not necessarily a male-specific aspect of this, but there's a catharsis in reading about characters who give in to their darker sides or struggle with their darker sides.
Mm.
So, for example... Dexter, which, you know, I don't think is necessarily a brilliant example because we probably shouldn't be lauding serial killers, but that fascination with serial killers is probably coming from this sort of need for catharsis.
Yeah, and I think it's also the same with early Walter White as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Because we'd also like to think that in the same position we'd be that ballsy, and then you realise how far down the rabbit hole he's fallen.
Yeah, absolutely. Also, just small anecdote, but I did have a moment of confusion when you said Dexter, forgetting a whole about Dexter as a TV show and thinking you were talking about your cat.
Yes.
And I was like, what's Dexter done? Jules, what's Dexter done?
Well, we know where the bodies are buried. My cat has got decidedly mouthy in her old age, though. She's 13 this year. Aww. And she is really, really mouthy. So.
She's a good girl.
She's reached the age of I don't give a fuck. I know you're not going to throw me out, so I'm going to tell you off.
I will scream into your face, mother, until you feed me, and there's nothing you can do about it. So yeah, I think you're right that it allows us to explore our own darker sides and our own darker needs. I mean, I think it's also why, you know, you watch things where someone does retaliate or someone sort of gets back at bullies or stuff like that, particularly if it's an underdog character who has been sort of abused and they turn around and they punish the people who've abused them. And then usually what happens is that they sort of then start going too far and then you're like, oh, no.
Oh, you've become the bully.
you've become the bully. But at first it's really cathartic. And it's cathartic because it's a fantasy. And you just dream about getting back at the people who've hurt you in a way. But in a fantastical setting, in a safe setting where nobody actually gets hurt, where you're not dealing with actual consequences. So absolutely, it feels good. And I think you even have this on sort of different levels where it goes to different extremes. So even on the good guys, you will get moments where they, you know, where they play a little bit into their dark side. Like one fantastic example is in Firefly, where Mal goes and has that duel.
Yeah.
And then at the end of having won the duel, he just stabs the guy just lightly a few more times. And he's just like, but I'm a good guy. And then he's like, but I'm a hero. Stabs him once. Oh, I'm a good guy. And then just one more time. Oh, I'm all right. and you laugh because in real life, if you saw someone actually stabbing someone else, you wouldn't, that wouldn't be a good thing. You wouldn't get that same sense of sort of vindication
No.
Because it's the difference between real life and fiction, which is why I think in fiction you do get these very dark characters.
Yeah, definitely. And we can't stress enough that it is the fantasy aspect. I mean, without wanting to derail the conversation, but the whole fan fiction setup, a lot of that is about exploring things that you wouldn't ever really dream of exploring in real life.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, for instance, before this episode started, I started talking about... Jules and I were actually talking about Supernatural.
Yeah.
And I was talking about the fact that I really sort of enjoyed season one, where Sam would have these horrifying headaches and have these death premonitions. And I was like, yeah, I'm all here for someone having, like, brain-shattering headaches. And Jules was like, I feel that as someone who has chronic headaches. And I was like, oh, God, this makes it sound really bad. Like, I'm like, yeah, Jules...
And I want you to suffer.
I want you to suffer. It's good for your character. Obviously not. I hate the idea of Jules being in pain. I hate the idea of anyone being in pain with that kind of awful kind of headache, particularly if it's chronic. That is not something I want in real life. But in fiction, moi. Okay, in fiction, if he's feverish and stumbling around and having nightmares, I'm there for it. I'm 100%, I'm in the room, you know. I'm super excited.
And Madeline is underselling Madeline is underselling herself here, because she's really in the room for that. As in, okay, so I've just hurt this character that you like. Is it too much? And you're like, no, hurt him a bit more. Yeah. Not quite hurt enough.
You know what? Like, oh, this is really great. You know what would be even worse, Jules? What? Do this. Oh, God.
What's wrong with you? But okay.
And again, I should emphasize that in real life, absolutely not. Like, it's awful. I literally end up feeling sick if I hear about someone being in pain like that. I absolutely do not want that in real life, but I love it in characters, okay? That's because it's the fantasy side of things, and because I'm really here for that hurt comfort, okay? Yeah, yeah. I make them really hurt, and then have someone take care of them. Ah, it makes me happy.
So another reason going back on our main discussion, the Beast Within thing is kind of an examination of reason and civilization versus baser instincts. So I think there can be a bit of a misunderstanding in terms of, you know, when you get the, in fact, you kind of get the sort of incel types who are kind of like, oh yeah, it's the law of the jungle, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, you don't really understand what the law of the jungle is, because the law of the jungle for humans was, we band together in a team or we get eaten. It wasn't, yeah the toughest one survives, because that didn't work. The reason we're here as a species is because we're collectively smarter than every other animal.
Yeah, collectively we're strong. We are.
Yeah.
Literally, and that's how it works.
And it's very specifically that we are collectively together, believe it or not, more intelligent than other animals. If you take a two-year-old and a chimp of a comparative developmental stage, the chimp will outperform the human two-year-old by about, you know, five times as fast. And they've tried it with various different comparable species, and we are stupider. Seriously, we are stupider and less cunning and less able to lie than all of them, except when you put us in a group and then suddenly we're fucking Shaft. You know? It's insane.
Which is also funny, because you then have the other side of it, which is one person can be intelligent but a crowd can be stupid. And I think that honestly that's because of the rule of average.
Yeah, you know, if we're talking about the mean intelligence of a group of 50 people, then, you know, my expectations aren't high. But yeah, in terms of working together in a small collective group, we're more intelligent. So, but I think we all like the idea of, what if we went back to nature? Could we be the toughest thing out there, kind of thing? And it sort of plays into that a little bit.
Hmm.
And a lot of it is about learning how to channel your aggressive tendencies, because they have a reason. I think it's wrong for us to say to be so sort of, you know, someone wanting to engage in sports with a sort of high violence content, like say rugby, for example. America, we don't strap on 20 pounds of armor to play rugby. to play rugby, which is American football to you guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, or you know, you want to do a martial art or something like that, or those feelings are perfectly natural. It's natural to want to exert yourself, to put yourself under physical stress like that. It's natural to have a bit of aggression that needs to come out, you know, regardless of your gender. The important thing is channeling in the right direction. I mean, the reason we had good hunters and that we managed to eat animals that then allowed us to develop better brains effectively is because we had those people with those aggressive tendencies who were willing to pit themselves against far stronger animals with natural weaponry that we just didn't have.
So yeah.
It's an important species survival trait, but it needs to be channeled in the right direction.
Yeah. It also makes me think of, you know, that idea, which is that the death rate of young men sort of in their teenage years, like, but I think it's between the ages of 18 and 25, 15, is incredibly
15 and 24. We were looking at it, weirdly, yeah. We were looking at it sort of yesterday.
Yeah. 15 and 24. It's alarmingly high. And I did see this, you know, list of, it was one of those, you know, clickbait things, which is, you know, a list of pictures of why men keep dying young. And one of them was a picture of a bunch of guys in an inflatable pool, like one of these really large ones, and they're all in there and they've got drinks, and I think they've got their laptops or something like that on, like, a platform. They are all speakers or music or something like that. But the thing that's the scariest is that they have on a floating noodle or something like that, they just have the extension cable just balanced there.
That's insane.
Honestly, that picture gave me anxiety. I was like, oh God, what are you doing? And it's this sort of this risk-taking thing as well, which I think plays into the whole the beast within as well. This, I w- not only just the aggression, but the need to take risks or to undermine your own safety or security.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's perfectly natural developmentally for both females and males, and you know, everyone else, to go through a stage in their sort of mid to late teens to mid to sort of early to mid 20s of wanting to expand their horizons, in the sense of wanting to move further away from home, wanting to mix with other people, and wanting to try new things. Again,
yeah,
that's perfectly normal. That again harks back to when we were living in caves and, you know, in small communities, whereby in order to make sure that the genetic stock got mixed around, you had to have this instinct to want to travel a little bit, so that people ended up seeding in various different places. So
yeah,
that's perfectly normal. But again, it should not mean that common sense completely flies out the window.
And yet.
Yeah. You know, young men like that, young males are far more likely to get into fights and take risky things. I feel a bit of a, you know, pot kettle black thing here, because I'm thinking of the time I went cliff diving at Portland. And it was something we all did in college, because it was kind of it was a rite of passage. So all the boys did it, and I'm kind of like, yeah, that looks fun. That's for me. That's a Jules thing. I'm going to jump off a cliff and hopefully not die in the Solent.
Jesus Christ, Jules. I mean, I think probably the closest equivalent is when I did start martial arts. It was that I did have quite a lot of aggression when I was a kid, for a lot of reasons. I was very angry. Part of that when I was very young was because I was sick, and then other reasons as well. I had a lot of anger. I wanted to fight, and it sounds weird, but I kind of wanted to also get beaten up. I kind of wanted to fight against, because I didn't want to fight against someone who was weak. I didn't want to hurt anybody. And that was the really important thing. I never wanted to hurt anybody. I didn't want to beat someone who was down. I didn't want to be a bully. What I wanted was to hit somebody who it wouldn't hurt, basically. I wanted to hit someone who wouldn't get hurt by me, but who might be able to push me around in turn so that I could really let out everything that was in there. And I think a lot of people was like, why is this tiny girl so full of rage? Why are you sort of looking, picking the biggest person in the room and being like, that one, the ex-marine, I will fight him.
See, I got that as well. Well, I started martial arts at 15, and free me doing that, I'd broken a few bones. Not my bones, I'd like to point out, but someone else's. Several someone else's. I think the thing was, I spent a lot of time on my own, and I looked like an easy target, so people would start on me, and then they'd regret it afterwards. And I had no control, because I'd never really learned to fight. So I'd learned things like, my dad had shown me how to throw a punch, how to knock someone over, you know, kick their legs out, how to throw a knife, which luckily I never actually experimented on with any people. And, you know, how to use a shotgun. So all the useful things that father daughters do together.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. How to put up shelves as well, actually. So that really was useful. Basic car maintenance, again, very useful. But I needed an outlet. I really genuinely needed that outlet. So I did Kung Fu, and then I went on and did karate, which really, really suited me, particularly as we did Goju-Ryu, which is the Okinawan karate, which tends to be less about it looking pretty and more about it being very fast, brutal and effective, which really suited me. But again, I was the only girl in that class for about 2 years, and it was all big blokes. And, you know, I was too old for the kid class.
Yeah.
And so I was like the smallest, lightest, teeniest person in that class. And some of the blokes were great, and some of the blokes were real dicks, as in, you know, they'd sort of chuck you around and then make jokes about raping you, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Good days, good times. There's a reason I earned the moniker Knacker Cracker.
Jesus Christ.
Eventually I gained all of their respect. They came to fear me and my tininess. To be fair, the blokes who were real dicks did eventually get, you know, sat on by the instructor and chucked out. And I think one really nasty piece of work bloke, after I'd smacked him a few times and the instructor had had a go at him, he just left, because you need the right sort of temperament to carry on a martial art properly.
Yeah.
And he obviously didn't have it.
No.
But yeah, that Madeline's right. That need for an outlet, that sort of need to be one with your bestial nature, if you like, is very definitely there.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, I think the other thing is that a lot of people assume that the bestial nature also only comes in the form of physical aggression or wanting to fight people.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. It can come in other forms of aggression as well, or other forms of extreme passion. So that can include, you know, being bitchy. It can include sort of actually just shouting at people or being cruel to other people with your words. But it can also include, actually, you might pour that into other things as well, and you might, and a lot of people pour that into very positive things. So I know a lot of people, and I myself as well, would pour a lot of negative emotions into music. Bashing that piano out, you know, playing the violin very, very hard until there were horse hairs everywhere. Sorry, I should say that the bow strings, I'm talking about the strings of the bow. It's not just randomly that horsehair just starts falling from the sky whenever you start playing really hard on the violin.
I followed you.
But yeah, so the beast within, I think the reason, again, that people connect with it so much in fiction is that everybody has that experience of the beast within, of pent-up anger, of pent-up rage, of wanting to pour all of that into something useful. And for some people, they don't have a positive outlet for it. So actually exploring it through fiction is the positive outlet, where they feel better because they can see it happening. I think it's also why a lot of people really enjoyed the recent Joker film, which I haven't watched, to be fair. But I think a lot of people enjoyed it because they feel very frustrated with society around them, and they want to pour that into something. So it's not necessarily necessarily that they look at the Joker and think, oh yeah, that's a role model. He's not. And if you think he is, I really suggest you seek help. Like, please. He's not a role model, but he is a vehicle of catharsis.
Yeah, absolutely. I have seen that film, and I both enjoyed it and gave it a bit of a side eye at the same time. It's fantastically acted. It doesn't feel to me like it's part of the Batman canon, but no. Then the Joker is a notoriously unreliable narrator in his own right. So it sort of fitted and it didn't fit at the same time, and in some ways it was kind of like, yeah, let's look at mental health warts and all, but it was also kind of perhaps not the best representation. So I have ambivalent feelings, but I can't deny it was a really good film, and I can see why people found it cathartic.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah.
Final minor point on this section is that, you know, for escapism purposes, women as well as men like to read about these characters or watch these characters. So
yeah.
You know, there's an element of this in the whole alpha male thing as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, we will not go into because we've canvassed that thoroughly.
Yes. Okay, so let's actually look at specifically what makes the beast within enjoyable as a trope.
Honestly, I think for me, like you, it's the mileage on the main character suffering.
So yes.
If it's done right, someone having to struggle with this part of their nature that they cannot get rid of. It's like the classic werewolf trope, for example. The darker side will completely and continually keep fucking up their life.
Yeah.
And that can be a very compelling thing to watch as they struggle for balance. You know, it's a very human struggle, isn't it? You know, the good me and the bad me kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I said, if it's done right, if it's not done right, it can become very annoying. It's about finding that balance. But yeah, ultimately it adds dimensions to characters. It gives us a little bit of you know, of them suffering, which everyone likes. Even if you say you don't, everyone likes it, because otherwise things wouldn't be interesting. It does work very well, and I think it's because, as we've said, it speaks to a very human part of everybody.
Yeah, definitely. And as writers, obviously, you can have a milder version of a character with a dark side. Someone who could be on the cusp of going completely dark. And then it can be a fun exploration to have another character come into their life, which forces them to go in another direction, or forces them to make the decision to go in another direction. So, for example, if we take a really a grumpy, cantankerous, misanthropic character who's really only out for himself, and then suddenly he's forced, or rather he makes the choice to look after this poor abused orphan type character. Madeline knows exactly who I'm talking about.
Cuthbert! Oh, yeah, you're damn right. I'm so here for that trope. Yeah, someone who's is almost on the cusp of being a not a nice person, who then takes in someone who's all bright and sunshine, and because of that has to kind of amend their ways. I love that so much.
Yeah. And it's an incredibly fun thing to write as well. It's a great exploration of sort of flirting with the darker side of human nature and then choosing grudgingly to go towards the light kind of thing.
Honestly, I do think it's why a lot of one fan fiction trope that is very popular is the saddled with a child trope.
Definitely.
And I think it's because people love to explore that idea of, okay, now you've kind of been forced into another role, which doesn't necessarily, particularly, I think they love it in like The Mandalorian. You've got this man, the Mandalorian character, and he's got little baby Yoda. I know that's not what the baby Yoda's called, but everyone calls him Baby Yoda.
Yeah.
And you know, that forces you to kind of, as a character, it forces you to be into a different role, particularly if you accept that role. And I really, really like that. I also like it when you get a character who's ultimately very good, who has something incredibly tragic happen to them, which forces them onto a dark side, which they almost fall into. So to give a good example of this, my partner and I have been recently rewatching My Hero Academia, which I think I've recommended to people before. It's so good. Really, really good if you're into anime, particularly any kind of anime with really good graphics and good fight scenes. Excellent stuff. Without giving too much away, there is a character at one point who his brother gets horrifically injured by a serial killer who's been going around murdering people and basically destroying lives. And this character, who is 100% a follow the rules kind of person, who is constantly like anal retentive level of, you know, don't sit on the desks, that's you know, disrespectful to our upperclassmen who sat at these desks and have become fine heroes kind of thing. Like, really, really follows the rules, 100% do-gooder kind of character, who suddenly has found that his brother, whom he admires the most, has been basically paralyzed for life and will never recover from his injuries, and that no one has been able to catch the person responsible. And because he's going through all of this alone, because he doesn't really talk to his friends about it, he essentially decides to go hunting for the serial killer himself in order to kill him.
Yeah.
To take his revenge. And it's a fantastic character arc, because in doing so, he basically completely gives up. He almost completely loses himself and goes down the path of no return. And it's incredibly engrossing, and it's very, very well done. And I think a lot of people like that sort of narrative because, again, it's really relatable, where you could be a person who says, I would never hurt anyone else, who doesn't take joy or like the idea of anyone else being in pain. And yet I think that everybody in the right circumstances would commit violence at some point, whether that violence would be in order to save their own lives, or whether they'd be driven to it by extreme trauma, or for revenge because they've lost somebody or somebody they love has been hurt. I think everybody can be driven to that, which is why that narrative of the beast within and the temptation of the dark side works so well in fiction.
Definitely. It's that curiosity about what would ever happen if we let our own inner beasts out of the cage.
Yes.
And obviously, as we've said before, the callback to nature, red in tooth and claw, and you know, a simple set of values in the sense of it's kill or be killed, which, you know, obviously it isn't. Even in nature it isn't, but sometimes I think people would like the option of cutting through the Gordian knot that is civilization.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so when is this trope not so great?
Yes, there are definitely examples of it where even as it's not actually a vehicle for catharsis anymore. It's something a lot darker. And I think one of the things that I really dislike is when this trope is used purely as an excuse for usually the male main character to dominate and exploit weaker characters, which are especially usually women, sometimes children, but usually women, and it's usually in a sexual way.
Yeah,
because absolutely. Heaven forbid it be anything else.
This is very particularly with a nice guy character who's kind of fed up of being overlooked and decides to explore the darker side, and I don't know, suddenly become some sort of stud kind of thing, except he's not. That's not enough. It's not enough to just It's almost classic incel rhetoric, isn't it? It's not just enough that he's become a Chad kind of thing. It's it must be anybody he wants kind of thing, no matter what.
Yeah.
It can get quite rapey.
Yeah, and I should point out, we're not talking about when this narrative is used to create a villain, when it's framed as this is not good behaviour. Like in Megamind, for example.
Yeah.
You have this very incel character who's obsessed with a woman who doesn't return his feelings, and when he gets superpowers he becomes a tyrant very quickly, and this is, you know, him letting out the darker side because he now has the power to enforce it. He is the villain. There's no doubting the fact that he is the villain. He's played as such. He's not sympathetic. We're talking about narratives where this is put forward as a, yeah, this is the hero character.
I have to say, this is where I even felt a little bit uncomfortable with Harry Dresden. I think it was, I want to say Winter's Night, but Cold Days. Cold Days. It was a good book, but the fact that Carrie taking on the Winter Mantle made him start looking at everyone who was female as something to basically have sex with was really quite uncomfortable. And, you know, suddenly he became more attractive to women as well. It was a bit disturbing. I'm glad that got dialed back in later books.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also this weird relationship people have, which I guess isn't really weird because, again, if we think of it in terms of it being a metaphor for puberty in some ways, but this relationship they have with the beast within and also being hypersexual.
Yes.
And also not only being hypersexual, but the beast within also being something that women are unnaturally attracted to.
Yeah, see, they did that with Lucifer a little bit, but it's not just women. And Lucifer's not kind of taking it. It's kind of like he never goes where he's not invited. He never tries to compel someone who's not interested.
Yeah, and I think the thing with Lucifer is that Lucifer reflects the desires that people have.
Yes.
You know, he says, "What do you desire?" That's his superpower. And so when people see him, they see the desires that they have reflected. Which for me means that it's less about kind of the beast within and being attracted to the beast, and more about the fact that he is the personification of what they happen to desire at that moment. And what they might desire is actually something, you know, exciting. It could be something sweet. It could be something tender. It doesn't really matter. They're not attracted to him because of necessarily who he is. They're attracted to him because he's the personification of their desire, which I think works quite well.
And that's the interesting thing. I mean, in the episode where they think that someone is going around killing his exes kind of thing. So they troop a bunch of his exes into the police station to interview them. And without doubt, every single one of them's like, "Oh yeah, it was the most amazing night of my life. It was absolutely incredible." And they were really open about it because it was just that incredible. And then they were like, "Yeah, so, you know, did you have a problem with him being with so-and-so?" And they were like, "No, I mean, it was just sex kind of thing. That's all it was." This was literally a bunch of people who were living out their fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was 100% a consensual fantasy. None of them said, "I don't know what came over me and I barely remember it the next night." It was 100%. They were all really happy with what had happened. They thought about it fondly, and that was it. Yeah. That was all there was to it.
Yeah, but it was very much, you know, the sex. It was them getting to give in to their beast within.
Yes.
Wasn't it? Not so much.
Yeah, like, and without
his
shame.
Facilitated. Yeah, without shame.
Without shame is that they got what they wanted out of him, and he was happy to give it. So, which is, I think, again, why Lucifer's quite such a sexual character as well. And this is a really interesting thing, is that usually there's a lot of sort of emphasis put on the guy just taking what he wants and that being really sexually attractive. Whereas Lucifer is, first of all, Lucifer's almost a tiny bit camp.
He just owns it.
He does, yeah. And he's definitely pansexual. This is canon. But it's also the fact that the emphasis isn't on him just taking what he wants and being sort of dominating and that being really, really sexually, you know, interesting. Every time they talk about having sex with Lucifer, they talk about what he did for them.
Yeah. In fact, there's even an element of, you know, when it looks like he's going to have to trade sexual favours, he'll be like, "Well, yes, I absolutely can," kind of thing. But it's more like it's part of his job kind of thing rather than...
Absolutely. And that's the thing, is that they say that he's a really, really excellent sexual partner, and the emphasis is on what he does for other people, not what he takes. Which is, again, what I really like about it, because it's this sense of, yeah, he's the one who's letting other people let the beast out, do what they want to do, without shame, without fear, but, you know, with great enthusiasm from their partner, which I just think is, that's actually a really healthy way of looking at it, considering that he's supposed to be the devil.
Definitely. So yes, more explorations in the way that Lucifer has framed it, and less in the way that sort of, oh yes, the man has now become super sexual and very attractive to all women and he cannot resist any of them kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. But it particularly always gets me when they're like, oh yeah, he's very sexual to all women, and I'm like, not to any men. That's when I start to get suspicious. None of them. There's no man out there like, whew, I really want him to pound me into a mattress. Like, I don't believe that's not the case.
You know, I'd really like it if you stopped hiding behind innuendo and hyperbole and said what you really meant, Madeline.
I am an open book, Jules.
Okay. The other example of why it can be not so great as a trope is when it's unnuanced. So you're just continuing the message of boys will be boys.
Yeah.
I think if you have a dark side that's going to fuck up your life and make you hypersexual, etc., or whatever, you know, you're letting out the beast within, there should be a high price to pay for that. So with the, again, going back to classic werewolf tropes, the man who's been bitten, who's been infected, generally then becomes very, very attractive to women, and he's stronger and he feels fitter and he feels great, you know? Yeah. The high price to pay for that is obviously that he loses himself completely and may commit murder. And ultimately, he knows, generally the werewolf accepts that he needs to die at some point because he's out of control. So you may not have to go to that tragic extreme, but there should be balance, definitely.
Yeah, it makes me think of sort of early Teen Wolf as well. You have, you know, a character who become, well, you look at Scott, he's the main character. He gets turned into a werewolf, which basically gives him much more physical prowess. He no longer has asthma. But because of the position he's in, he also finds himself in a position of heavy responsibility, which is really disrupting his school life. So yeah, he can now play on the lacrosse team, which is what he's always wanted to do. But there are people who are trying to hunt him and kill him because he's a werewolf. He has to fight in order to learn to control himself so that he doesn't hurt anybody. He has all of these other things which are kind of, you know, stacking down on top of him. And it is very much a I have to control this or I will hurt somebody. And he's not giving in to the dark side, actually. And it's one of the things I actually really liked about the show is that Scott remains this incredibly sweet character. He's just actually a real sweetheart the entire time, who just loves his mother, and that's it. He loves his mother, he loves his best friend. And
it's so refreshing.
It's very refreshing.
Definitely. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you guys think? Is this a trope that you enjoy? Is this something that you feel is well explored or could be done better? Have you got ideas of how you'd like to see it done?
Yeah, please let us know. Remember, you can get in contact with us via our Twitter, our Facebook, or our Tumblr, both individually or through the Dissecting Dragons page. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And believe it or not, it's not going to be Lucifer. But Jules, I think anyone who's listened to this episode by now has realised that we are recommending Lucifer. But we do actually have another recommendation this week. And Jules, I believe you've got one for us.
Yes, despite saying probably weren't going to get Disney Plus, I ended up with a 3-month free trial through my phone. So, through my phone contract. And so basically we decided we were going to get it and watch The Mandalorian. This is me and my partner, obviously, not me and Madeline. Madeline and I have not actually seen each other in person for about a year and a half now.
Yeah, in fact, it's been over a year and a half.
Yeah.
Which is painful.
Totally sucks, but, you know, pandemic. So we got that and it was a good time to get it because there were 2 seasons of The Mandalorian out, and The Mandalorian is my recommendation. And even though they're shorter episodes than what you'd be used to probably from something like Netflix for comparison, you can probably watch three in a night and you know, then you get a decent chunk of the show. And it okay, I take my hat off to Disney Plus because you know what, they are providing some good content, definitely. The Mandalorian is funny. It's one of the best returns to the Star Wars universe I've ever seen, and it's not even looking at, you know, necessarily the Force and the Skywalkers or anything. It's a huge universe, and this is just a tiny little chunk of it. And you've got the Mandalorian himself, who is a part of a quasi underground, vaguely religiousy type sect, who are supposed to be extinct but are not. And he works as a bounty hunter and occasional assassin, and he's very jaded and also very staid and sort of very much sort of tied to his own personal code, which is that if he takes on a job, he delivers. And then what literally happens is he ends up with that literal saddled with a child trope, as Madeline was saying earlier, which makes him question everything. So again, we're looking at someone who is teetering on the edge of their dark side and having to choose not to go down that road completely, that maybe there is a better way of doing things. And it's just incredibly good. It's really, really great storytelling. So I wouldn't say like go and change your viewing schedule, go and get Disney Plus no matter what, because it may not have everything you want yet. But it's definitely worth going, I guess I'll get it for a month and like binge watch The Mandalorian.
I'm quite curious about The Mandalorian, but now that you've just confirmed that it is essentially guy on the cusp of falling into the dark place gets saddled with a baby, I mean, you just ticked all the boxes for me right there.
It is absolutely Madeline catnip, I promise you. I'm surprised you haven't seen it, to be honest.
Well, on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.